Hi, it's the show on KJZZ. I'm Steve Goldstein.
And I'm Mark Brody, and this is our podcast version of the program. The show is one of our original productions. It's a curated program of news and features from Phoenix and the state, along with national and international stories.
You can also find segments and additional information at theshow.kjzz.org.
Thanks for listening to the podcast.
Good afternoon. It's the show on 91.5 in Phoenix. I'm Steve Goldstein. We're expecting to stay sunny and breezy through the rest of this afternoon around the valley. Look for a high of 85. Should have clear skies tonight with a low near 60. In valley traffic, there's a collision I-10 eastbound at 51st Avenue blocking the HOV lane. Just a few minutes ago, the Arizona Diamondbacks announced they won't be bringing back general manager Dave Stewart or manager Chip Hale. Both lasted 2 years with the organization. A new report suggests the Arizona Department of Child Safety could improve several practices when permanently placing abused or neglected children in new family settings. As KJZZ's Kerry Young reports, one of the biggest issues was communication with the court system.
Before a child can be reunited with parents, DCS is required to provide judges with written court reports and in-person information at court hearings about a case's plan goals. But the Arizona Auditor General's office found the department isn't consistently completing these documents on time or with enough detail. Mark Owen is with the state auditor's office. He says his department recommended DCS track report submission timeliness and include more review from caseworker supervisors.
The court reports that they provide to the courts help the courts ensure that children can achieve permanency in a timely manner.
DCS said it did not agree with the auditor on this issue and would not implement the suggestions. They were in agreement on some other findings, though, and plan to implement those recommendations. Kerry Young, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
Annual campus crime statistics for ASU and the U of A came out on Friday, and KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins has been looking over the numbers. Jimmy, first of all, what is the data and where does it come from?
This is data that resulted from the Clery Act, which is a federal law that requires colleges and universities that take federal financial aid money, they have to keep crime stats for their campuses. It's the result of a rape and murder that occurred in the 1980s in Pennsylvania. It prompted a closer look at unreported crimes on college campuses.
Well, so what did we learn about numbers at the state's two largest public universities?
Things like burglaries were up. There was also an increase at both campuses in drug arrests, while there was a decrease in alcohol arrests. So this could reflect changing priorities of students or the police in as far as what they're consuming more of or focusing their enforcement efforts on. Reports of sexual assaults are also on the rise. However, Lee Gardner is a senior reporter at the Chronicle of Higher Education. He says that may have more to do with an increase in reporting as opposed to actual number of assaults.
I think that there's definitely more of a focus on sexual assault and reporting it and colleges trying to do their best to respond to them properly. One of the things that's happened in recent years is that colleges have stepped up their efforts to deal with sexual assault. In many cases have been compelled to step up their efforts to address sexual assault through Title IX cases. And so this may not represent a rise in sexual assaults, which have always been a little bit difficult to track anyway. It may just represent a rise in reporting.
Jimmy, when parents look at these reports, when they're trying to decide what a safe place is to send their kids for school, what kinds of things should they be keeping in mind?
They should keep the data in context. Gardner says one of the biggest limitations of the Clery data is actually its scope.
The tricky thing about the Clery Act is that while it has done a lot to revolutionize campus security over the past quarter century, it still only offers a fairly limited view of the crimes that actually take place. That is, you know, it is generally a pretty accurate take on what individual crimes happen on campus, but it doesn't record, for instance, anything that happens off campus. So, you know, I had a college police chief tell me that as many as two-thirds of the sexual assaults on her campus took place off campus, and Clery is going to capture none of those. A mass murder could take place two blocks off campus, and it would never show up in a Clery report.
Is there a better way to look at the numbers to try to understand the dangers of a certain campus?
Well, you could look at local police agencies' reports as well, but Gardner says that's just another task for already overburdened parents and students making a really big decision.
That would be tricky because not only are you then looking at Cleary data, you're also looking at local police data, and for some jurisdictions that can be several different police departments. And, you know, frankly, the evidence is there that the Cleary data is not, and the Cleary reports are not consulted very often by students when they're picking a school. So there's some question as to its efficacy in terms of giving a guide to students about how safe their campus is, because it appears that maybe as few as 1 in 10 of students ever look at it.
And Gardner says that's not insignificant. A lot of people spend tons of money compiling these reports, and they're under great pressure and scrutiny to get it right. If you underreport or report an incident that didn't happen on your campus, a university could face huge fines.
A big state institution, I wrote about the University of Connecticut, spends the University of Connecticut spends about $400,000 every year on Cleary compliance, with training and all the other things that they have to do to make sure that this report comes out that has this data. And institutions that size, I don't think that that's an unusual number. So, you know, this is something that is a big effort for police departments, and it's very complicated, but they're compelled to do it by federal law. And, you know, it would be nice to think that people actually pay that much attention to it, but it appears that they do not.
So Steve, Gardner says it's a valuable resource. Parents and students should definitely check it out, but treat it like all data. Don't just focus on 1 year. Cleary reports compare 3 years of stats, so keep the data in context and look at how it changes year to year.
KJZZ's Jimmy Jenkins. Jimmy, thank you.
My pleasure, Steve. Thank you.
Arizona is the latest state to join a new growing energy market in the West. This weekend, the state's largest utility, Arizona Public Service, entered what's known as the Energy Imbalance Market, which includes a handful of states. It's expected Arizona's participation will have big benefits for the utility and its customers, and KJZZ's Will Stone joins us to explain how. So, Will, currently, how does the energy market work?
Steve, Arizona is already buying and selling power with utilities across the West in what's known as the wholesale market. And so if you go to APS, the headquarters downtown where I've been, there's a room with a bunch of traders who are parked in front of lots of screens, and they're monitoring the energy prices and the weather and all sorts of factors that affect how much energy is being produced and customer demand. And so that's known as the wholesale market. And the goal is always to get the best deals. So there may be a time, for example, when California has a surplus of energy, and so the prices are dropping there. Meanwhile, Arizona may need more energy because it could be hotter here and people are cranking up their ACs or whatnot. And then the traders are responsible for essentially trying to buy the cheap power when it's beneficial from California or other states, and then selling power when we can make money off of that. That is how it already works. The energy imbalance market essentially improves that whole system.
Okay, so how does it do that?
So at the moment, APS can only buy power an hour in advance. So that requires the utility to constantly anticipate what customer demand will be. And you can imagine that's not always the most precise way because demand can change pretty rapidly. For example, there could be a cloud that goes over a solar farm and all of a sudden the output from that solar farm is going to drop a lot. Then APS still needs to find where else it's going to get the power in that moment. So they may ramp up a gas fire plant or something like that. So the energy imbalance market allows APS to buy in increments of 5 minutes or even 15 minutes, but much closer to real time. And so it allows them to really just get better deals when they're buying power from neighboring states. And the energy imbalance market, it started in California and the Pacific Northwest, and it's growing slowly.
So in the bigger picture then, what's the ultimate benefit going to be for the customers of APS? How are they going to see a difference, if any?
The benefit is primarily financial. APS anticipates it could save anywhere from $7 to $18 million a year by participating in the Energy Imbalance Market, the EIM. And the market started, like I said, in California. As more states join it, Nevada joined it recently, and other utilities, Utah, you're going to see more and more savings. And that ultimately gets passed down to the ratepayers, the APS customers. So far, all the participants in the market have saved about $90 million. So the hope is it will trickle down to people's bills and they'll save a little money.
KJZZ's Will Stone teaching us about the energy imbalance market and APS's role. Will, thank you.
Thanks, Steve.
Recent polling done by the Morrison Institute and the Arizona Republic indicates there may be some buyer's remorse related to the passage of the education funding measure Proposition 123. It modified how much state land trust money is distributed to Arizona's public schools to the tune of $3.5 billion over 10 years. But some are concerned that progress has been slow and that there's not a second step, an unofficial Prop 456. With me to talk about that is Joe Thomas, president of the Arizona Education Association. Joe, you were one of the big supporters of Proposition 123. Are you having any second thoughts?
Not a single one. I see all these anecdotal stories on social media about teachers that are very happy with the raises that they received. School boards were very happy to give those raises to teachers and our education support professionals. And I think that it came in the nick of time to keep more of our teachers in the classroom. We saw a report released by the Arizona School administrators, I believe, that show that we had 460 teachers leave the classroom this year in the first month, and we have about 2,000 additional classrooms that are not being serviced or not being led by a certified or a licensed teacher. We needed that money, and I'm glad the voters gave it to us. It was a first step, and now we need to make sure that we restore some of the other money that's been cut over the years from education.
To settle the K-12-related lawsuit, a lot of different groups, a lot of interests were at the table. Is that the sort of thing that needs to be going on to figure out what that next step would be, what some people are calling 456?
Right. I think any time that you're going to be looking at education policy or education funding behind that policy, you need to have the stakeholders at the meeting. You need to have the School Boards Association. You need to have the school administrators. And you certainly need to have AEA. We represent 20,000 teachers and support staff around the state. And we are hoping that voters will elect a legislature that's a little bit more supportive of our schools so we can have more talks about how best to address school funding.
And Joe, whether it's unofficial polls or official polls, most people in Arizona seem to believe that more funding for K-12 is an absolute necessity.
Yes.
Where does the extra funding come from? Where can it come from?
Well, I think Arizona is a rich state. I think that we have moved out of the recession like the rest of the nation. And what the results that we saw in this most recent survey are not different from what we saw in our post-election poll that AEA sponsored right after Prop 123 passed. The majority of voters support increased funding for our schools, but they want to fully fund our schools, not just this inflationary piece.
And for some of those folks who may be expressing buyer's remorse about Proposition 123, are you saying that without that, things would even be worse?
Absolutely, things would be worse. If our teachers were counting on Prop 123 to pass, I wish that we had been able to put more money in the classroom, and we're not stopping until we see that $1 billion in cuts put back into the classroom. We've got to reinvest back in our schools. We've got to get class size down, get workload to where it's manageable, and give the students the one-on-one time that they need with their teachers to make sure that they can be successful. So if anyone thinks that they made a bad decision by supporting Proposition 123, I would ask them to call a teacher and ask the teacher how they feel about it. It's not enough, but it was enough to stop the flow of teachers leaving the classroom. I think we would have had hundreds of more teachers decide that Arizona was not the place they wanted to have their career if we had not passed Proposition 123. We must do more, but Proposition 123 was the first step, and it was an important step in keeping many of our talented teachers to where they wanted to stay in Arizona.
Joe Thomas is president of the Arizona Education Association. And Joe, thank you. Take care. Bye-bye.
Steve.
It's the show on 91.5, along with the takeaways. John Hockenberry, I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening this afternoon. And forget Brexit, folks. Over the weekend in Colombia, it was Farxit.
A referendum to ratify a historic peace deal in Colombia was rejected. A slim 50.24% of Colombia's voters, in a major shocker, rejected 4 years of negotiations between Colombian President Juan Manuel Santos and FARC leader Timoleon Jimenez, leaving open the possibility that the more than half century of conflict between these two sides would continue. Former Colombian President Uribe, who led the opposition to the peace accord, was calling for national unity after the vote. We begin with Nadia Drost, who is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. She says there was no warning whatsoever for this outcome from the Colombia weekend vote.
I think there is a sense of complete and utter shock here throughout Colombia, both for Colombians who voted yes in support of the peace accords, but also for those who rejected them. The no side never expected to win. So the country has really been tossed into a state of confusion, looking for explanations and not really knowing what is going to happen next.
Is there any statistical indication of what happened? Did a lot of people stay home because they thought it was a foregone conclusion? And did the polls, which showed that yes was going to win, mean that a lot of people who didn't really want no to happen felt like they could vote their conscience?
We haven't seen detailed statistical analysis come in, but there is this big statistical upset where the expectations were so different from the results. As you said, polls leading up to the vote showed that the yes vote would sail in quite comfortably, and instead the no vote came in just a razor's edge ahead. One explanation is that, first of all, Colombia has a historical tendency to have very low voter turnout for any kind of election, and we saw that yet again. So only 37% of the electorate actually voted in what is probably the most important vote in Colombia's history. We had huge torrential rainstorms, particularly along the Atlantic coast, which polls had showed were more in favor of the yes side. That is a kind of stronghold of President Santos. And so, you know, there is speculation that perhaps if more people in rain-affected areas had been able to get out to vote, maybe it would have tipped it the other way, because the difference in the votes was so marginal. We're talking about a mere 50,000 votes.
Nadia, this has a quality of the Wizard of Oz to it. I mean, what happens now? It's as though the people of Colombia have told the FARC and the government, okay, bring us the broomstick of the Wicked Witch of the West, go back and fight.
Exactly. This was a minor miracle that this peace accord actually was signed. It was 4 years in the making. We're talking about ending a 52-year-old war. And the fact that so many Colombians voted against it and decided essentially not to give peace a chance has so many people dumbfounded. As to what is next, nobody knows. In fact, there seems to be no plan B on the part of either the government or the FARC. This possibility was simply not expected. We heard President Santos last night address the public and say that he was going to be calling for a meeting today, bringing together all political factions. That includes his rival, former President Álvaro Uribe, who has been the most ardent supporter and leader of the No campaign. And what's expected is that they will be talking about a possible renegotiation. Now, this opens a whole Pandora's box of complications. You can imagine if it was this difficult for the FARC and the government to reach an agreement on their own, and it took 4 years, if you bring in Álvaro Uribe, who has been both the arch enemy of President Santos as well as the FARC, I don't know how much longer it's going to take to renegotiate an agreement. What is surprising is that both the FARC and the government in the past have said that if this peace deal is not accepted, they would not go back to the negotiating table. There seems to be an openness on both parts to perhaps give that a try. The FARC also, in a statement last night, said that they are still committed to using words and not weapons in the search for peace in the future.
Well, let's hope that holds out. There were ripples throughout Latin America over the weekend as this vote and the shock settled in other places. I'm wondering what the implications are for the region. And is this political squabbling and a chess game, or do people in Colombia really have misgivings about any kind of a deal that doesn't punish the FARC more for the war?
I think this vote has really been a moment of reckoning for Colombians. And what it has essentially shown is that there are a lot of people who are not either willing to forgive the FARC or cannot simply face two major aspects of the peace accords. And one is that the FARC, under these peace accords, would not see traditional jail time. They would see alternative sentences. And the other is that they would have the chance to participate in politics. And those two things are very difficult for a lot of members of Colombian society to stomach. I think that on the side of the FARC, this vote sends a very strong message to them that the Colombian public is not ready to accept them back into society. And I think that, you know, often in the mountains and jungles of Colombia right now, there are a lot of very nervous FARC fighters thinking, what does this mean for them? Do they have to go back to war? And if they don't, what kind of security guarantees are they going to have coming out of the bush eventually to a society which is not ready to accept them?
Nadia Dross is a Bogota-based reporter on assignment for the PBS NewsHour. Thanks so much, Nadia.
Thank you, John.
And that's John Hockenberry at The Takeaway. Agriculture was a key industry long before Maricopa County transformed into one of the nation's most populous regions. As KJZZ's Mariana Dale reports, undocumented citrus workers went on strike 39 years ago today in the West Valley.
Cars zip past the hospital, homes, and strip malls that make up present-day Arrowhead Ranch in Glendale. But let's go back to a time when citrus groves eclipsed this strip of desert. Beneath those trees, undocumented migrants lived and toiled in squalid conditions. They reportedly made less than a dollar an hour.
People treat livestock better than farm workers at that point.
Don Devereaux was a journalist turned labor organizer. After reporters found migrants living in shacks made of orange crates, Devereaux helped found the Maricopa County Organizing Project, or MCOP.
Our first target, because it was the most powerful ranch in town, was Arrowhead Ranch.
Anti-union legislation had forced big-name organizers like Cesar Chavez out of Arizona a few years before.
Our plan was to fake them out, if you will, by being a civil rights organization.
MCOP did something new. They laid the foundation for the strike in Mexico, telling workers there what they could gain from organizing. And on October 3, 1977, when the harvest was at its peak, undocumented workers walked off the job at Arrowhead Ranch. As Tucson attorney Jesus Romo remembers, the Border Patrol showed up the same day.
They came in with helicopters and trucks and, you know, you name it.
Devereaux says some picketers sought refuge within the trees that covered Arrowhead Ranch's thousands of acres.
And it became the largest institutionalized game of hide-and-seek I've ever seen.
The strike made local and national news, in part because the Goldwater family owned a stake of Arrowhead. One Washington Post headline declared, quote, illegal aliens have been striking in Arizona citrus groves.
Nobody thought undocumented workers would have the cojones to go out and do that.
And Romo says the workers stuck with the plan, even as the Border Patrol continued deportations.
These are people who were willing to sacrifice everything and to risk everything to go to another country where they knew they would be mistreated.
The strike ended in about 3 weeks. Negotiations ensued. And the sides reach a contract in 1979. The deal established a pay scale for different kinds of citrus and guaranteed workers at least the federal minimum wage. It also promised work supplies, clean drinking water, and sanitation. Ana Raquel Mignon is a history professor at Stanford University.
The Arrowhead Ranch strike represents the first strike, that we know about at least, in which undocumented workers explicitly demanded their rights while asserting that they were in the country without proper authorization.
And MCOP leaders didn't forget what motivated people to illegally migrate. The contract set aside 10 cents of every dollar a worker made for economic development projects in Mexico. Mignon says the money helped pay for a large irrigation project, pig farm, and a rig for building wells.
All these projects led Mexican families, which had been completely dependent on wages earned by migrants in the United States, to begin dreaming about making their livelihoods together in Mexico.
Organizers say many of the workers stayed and helped build the stucco subdivisions of Arrowhead Ranch. There are still a few orange trees in the road medians and a small grove near the hospital. Daniel Pizzullo was there on a recent weekend taking pictures for his Instagram.
It's really pretty, like when the sun's like shining through the trees right now and like all the oranges that are on the trees.
He's never heard of the ranches or the history made here almost 40 years ago. Mariana Dale, KJZZ News, Phoenix.
This story was co-produced by KJZZ's Matthew Casey, and you can see historical photos and a timeline at kjzz.org. Hillary Clinton and Donald Trump don't agree on much, but both have said they support the concept of paid family leave. This marks the first time that both major party nominees favor paid leave. Clinton's plan would allow up to 12 weeks, while Trump advocates for six. Dave Wells, research director for the Grand Canyon Institute, has looked into how many states have paid family leave and why expanding that would be a positive step. Dave, how is this different from the Family Medical Leave Act, or FMLA?
The Family Medical Leave Act, which was passed in 1992, it gives you 12 weeks of unpaid family leave. And it's unpaid. That's the weakness of it, meaning that can you go 3 months without a paycheck? A lot of us can't. And especially if you're a low-income person, you can't do it. But the good part about it is it means if you do take it, you still have your job when you go back. They can't take your job away from you. And about three-quarters of American workers qualify for it. There are exceptions if you have a small employer of less than 50 employees, or if you haven't been there for a full year, there's cases where you may not qualify for the FMLA benefits.
So how is the U.S. doing in general when it comes to paid family leave? How does it compare to other countries?
Not too good. We can put it that we're like 40-some years behind schedule here. In 1970, there were 30 countries that had paid family leave, and the average amount of time was 17 weeks. Hillary Clinton's proposal is 12, and Donald Trump's is 6. Today, there are 41 countries with paid family leave. The typical length of the paid family leave is 52 weeks, a whole year. If you decide to go north of the border, you can get 52 weeks of paid family leave. If you decide to go south of the border, you can get 12 weeks. But here you get zero.
How significant is it that the two major party candidates both support some sort of paid leave?
I think it's huge because it's the first time it's ever happened. I say we are an extreme outlier. I think, you know, if Donald Trump were to become president, the Republicans would pretty much be obliged to have to enact something. And I would be hopeful that if Hillary Clinton becomes president, that we could have a nice dialogue to see what could move forward.
What are some of the most important benefits, you think? And are there any potential pitfalls of implementing paid family leave?
Yeah, I'm not aware of really any serious pitfalls. There was a survey of employers in California. And California's our main source of data because they've had it in place for over 10 years. Mm-hmm. Other states like New Jersey only been 2009, and a lot of other states are just coming online now. And they did a survey of 500 employers in California, and they found about 90% of them thought it had a neutral or positive impact. Generally, the research is quite positive in a lot of different ways. One thing is, and I'm not a geneticist, but there's these epigenetic impacts, and the epigenetic impacts means that in the early months of development for a child, that your genes aren't like set in stone. If you're put in a more stressful environment, then that actually affects you your entire life, or can. And if you're put in a more nurturing, positive kind of environment, then you're in a much better state as you grow up, and you can deal with stress better and other kinds of things. So that kind of research indicates that being able to provide a parent with an ability to bond and nurture their child in a positive way is a really good thing. They actually find that if you have paid family leave, you're less likely to need food stamps or public assistance. And most likely that has to do with the fact that it's really hard when you have a newborn. They're not necessarily the most cooperative little beings in the world. And so it's very hard for people to manage the needs of the newborn and keeping a job.
Is there any reason to think that this is an idea that more states may adopt and then Arizona might jump on the bandwagon? Are you hearing anything that indicates it's even being discussed?
It hasn't really been discussed, but we passed First Things First a few years ago. So the voters of Arizona want to see more money put into early childhood. And that, of course, was funded with a tobacco tax. So it was sort of a tax that's sort of a bad sin kind of tax. But I said generally the way most states fund it is it's self-financed. It's not something that they're imposing on employers. It's something that they're putting on employees. Mm-hmm. And it's sort of like an insurance kind of system. So, and in fact, you know, Donald Trump wants to use our unemployment insurance system as his way of funding it. So it's something it's a relatively low-cost program because there's not a lot of people going out on leave all the time.
Dave Wells of the Grand Canyon Institute. Dave, thanks as always.
All right. Thank you.
Arizona is the best state in the country when it comes to services for people living with intellectual and developmental disabilities. That's according to a new report from United Cerebral Palsy, which tracks state-by-state community living standards for people with developmental disabilities.
Arizona has always been the number one or the number two state for the life of these rankings.
Taryn Bragdon is the researcher who has written this study for the last decade, and he says Arizona has consistently been at the top of the list for one simple reason.
And that's because the state really prioritizes those adults with developmental disabilities with helping them live in the community, safely participate and be a part of the community.
Bragdon says people with developmental disabilities don't want anything different than the rest of us. They want to live normal lives with a home to live in and a job so they can contribute to our community. But those things are often difficult for them to find. The show's Lauren Gilger took a closer look at this report, and she joins us now. And Lauren, what exactly did this report find that Arizona does well in this area?
So the report highlighted that Arizona does a great job of keeping families together, supporting families caring for children with disabilities at home. It said we have shorter waiting lists for services than most states, and that people with developmental disabilities here say they feel safe and have a wide range of relationships. But the most important factor, according to Bragdon, was our state's perspective on people with disabilities.
A lot of states really look at having a bias towards larger institutions. That might be larger group homes, anywhere from 6, 12, 20 people living together, whereas what Arizona does is it looks at focusing on individuals either living in family foster care or in very small settings like an apartment. So basically, supporting folks living in the same kind of way that you and I do.
So does everyone agree that Arizona is the best in this arena?
Well, Bragdon says even though we rank highly, there is still a lot of work to be done, always. And this report is specific to people with intellectual and developmental disabilities. I also spoke with Larry Wanger. He's the executive director of the State Independent Living Council here in Arizona. And he says when you broaden this out and talk about the wider community of people with disabilities, the picture isn't always so bright.
I don't want folks to mistakenly get this information and think, oh, well, there's no need in our state. We're doing so well. That's not the case.
Where do you see that need?
So transition services, while it is noted as being something that we do well here, I think the reality is that there is definitely room for improvement, not just for folks cited in this report, but for the broader disability community in terms of making sure that prior to folks graduating from school, they're getting information about options, you know, what choices they have before they leave the school environment. Through our youth activities, we know that a lot of youth who have disabilities don't get this information. We look at employment, and again, if we look more broadly at the larger disability community, the reality is that, you know, nationally we hear a statistic that roughly 70% of working age people who have disabilities are unemployed. In Arizona, we have now over 550,000 persons with a variety of disabilities between the ages of 21 and 64. So you can kind of look at that and say, well, 70% of that's about 380,000. And so that is a significant segment of our population between the ages of 21 and 64 that's unemployed.
Right. You said also that is housing one of the issues?
Yeah, one of our responsibilities as a council is to travel across the state and conduct forums. So we do that to gather information. And year after year when we do these, we hear about three specific issues, and it never changes, unfortunately, and that would be transportation, so access to transportation. That would be access to employment opportunities and access to affordable and accessible housing.
What can be done to help these kinds of things? Are there enough of these sorts of resources out there and people just don't know how to find them? Or is it a matter of really getting some more funding into programs that would address some of these issues?
Yeah, it's definitely a little bit of both. You know, we find that folks don't always know what's available, but we also know that just the limitations on funding that's available. Let me give you an example. For the past several years, we have had a situation where our state has not provided the level of funding that would result in us being able to fully fund our state vocational rehabilitation services program. And that program is specifically designed to provide vocational training and job placement assistance for folks who have disabilities in our state. It's up to each state to provide enough funding to draw down their share of federal funds. And we have not done that for years. And the result of that has been that thousands of folks have been on a waiting list for years to get assistance from this agency. That's an example where, given more funding, the agency could better address the need and have a direct impact both on the lives of folks who have disabilities who become employed, but on our economy.
That was the show's Lauren Gilger speaking with Larry Wanger, Executive Director of the State Independent Living Council. LGBT youth face dramatic challenges even as tolerance generally grows in the U.S., and being open with one's sexuality is finding more areas of encouragement. But for LGBT youth of color, the difficulties can be multiplied. At the same time, not much research into their lives and experiences has been done. It was U of A Assistant Professor Russell Toomey and colleagues who found that studies on the health and well-being of LGBT youth of color were extremely limited, and Professor Toomey joins me now. Professor, how much can coming out to family members or friends be complicated by also being a person of color?
So our review actually showed that the coming out process, in the very few studies, I do want to mention that there were very few studies that actually looked at the coming out process across different racial and ethnic minority youth, but that those responses to coming out were not that much different in terms of one's racial or ethnic background. And so they may face additional challenges if their cultural group has some specific ideas or values or attitudes around sexual orientation or gender identity and expression. However, that was not really shown in the literature.
How often is that time of life for a teen or maybe someone slightly younger? How often does that, even just if we compress all these things together, the idea of perhaps coming out, and maybe that's uncomfortable depending on what the family situation is, then you add on top of that you're a member of a minority group, and the average teen is going through all sorts of stressful hormonal changes and whatnot. How difficult a time can that be when we compress all of those things together?
That raises really important points and actually addresses some of what was lacking in the current research literature. So we actually have very little information about how, for instance, adolescents who are sexual minority or gender minority youth who also identify as racial or ethnic minority youth are dealing and juggling with not only the everyday stresses and struggles of adolescence, but adding on to that heterosexism and bullying related to their sexual orientation or gender identity, and then adding on institutional and interpersonal racism to that. I think, you know, it creates this climate for that young person that may be difficult to navigate if they don't have the skills necessary to cope with multiple forms of discrimination.
Is this an easier time to be an LGBT teen person of color, or are there some people who are offended, repulsed by this idea, and so if they face something in the world that is critical, those critics may in fact be harsher?
Yes, so I think that this is a really complicated question. So, of course, we've seen attitudes become more progressive or more accepting or tolerant, if you will, of LGBT individuals in the U.S., but at the same time, when we look at the structural levels, we still see several anti-LGBT policies being introduced into the U.S. Congress, for example, hundreds in the past year. And so when we translate to what adolescents are experiencing, we actually do know that they are still experiencing fairly high levels of victimization related to their sexual orientation and gender expression in schools. So there was actually just a report released yesterday by GLSEN, the Gay, Lesbian, Straight Educator Network, and it showed that while things have improved in the past decade, that the picture is still quite grim for LGBT youth in our schools.
How important is it for that research into this to expand? And if in fact it does expand, are there certain areas you would like to see it focus on?
Yes, if it does expand, which I do believe it will, I think we really need to start thinking about the strengths that LGBT young people of color have that we might be ignoring, such as their experience as a racial and ethnic minority, and how does that prior experience maybe help mitigate any negative experiences they have related to their sexual orientation or gender identity and expression.
Russell Toomey is an assistant professor at the U of A. He's looked into the limited number of studies on LGBT youth of color. Law enforcement officials around the country are paying closer attention to how they police their communities in light of several high-profile shootings and incidents involving officers nationwide. Here in the Valley, recent action against police violence has resulted in the closure of roads and the arrest of some protesters, but nothing that compares to the issues encountered in places like Dallas, Baltimore, and Tulsa. KJZZ's Phil Latzman recently paid a visit to a local gathering featuring more than 100 members of Arizona's law enforcement community to find out how they're dealing with a new reality in American policing.
36 agencies, including city, county, state, and tribal forces from around the state, were represented at the Law Enforcement Appreciation Luncheon in Phoenix. Though the first thing you couldn't help but notice in the room of chiefs, commanders, and lieutenants was that it was very white. Roy Minter is the exception. He's the African-American chief of Peoria's force.
One of the things that's really important to us in the law enforcement profession is not just diversity at the top of the organization, but diversity at all levels in the organization. And that really stresses the importance of recruiting a very diverse candidate pool.
But how hard is it still to do that?
Well, I don't think it's that hard because you've still got a lot of people out there in different communities who are interested in this outstanding, fabulous career.
But he and others at the event admit that departments around the valley and the state need to do a better job of connecting with those candidates.
You have to have a diverse police force to understand the issues that are in the communities.
That's John Meza, who is the police chief in Arizona's third largest city, Mesa.
You see most of the police agencies are trying to change that. You know, like in Mesa, where we have really robust recruiting efforts, we changed the model of how we do the hiring process to attract more minority officers, because you really want your police force to reflect your community.
What's also readily apparent is the lack of females in the room of law enforcement honchos. The only one present is Tempe's chief, Sylvia Moore.
I think diversity is about something more than simply race, culture, and gender. It's about experience, education, perspective, and an array of things that aren't often considered at first blush.
Chief Moore was named to her position earlier this year, and she has already faced criticism from members of the black community over her department's handling of the fatal shooting of 19-year-old Dalvin Hollins, who was killed while suspected of committing a robbery back in July. They've even asked for her resignation. Moore admits that departments like hers have work to do to improve trust.
Well, I think it's absolutely in the consciousness of everyone across this nation. I think most of us recognize police officers are one part of a greater criminal justice system. We do bear the brunt of much of the frustration because we're the visible symbol.
Richard Bradshaw is a commander on Glendale's force. He says incidents around the country involving cops have helped open a new dialogue with his crew.
We have those conversations with our officers to say, in general, some of the negativity that's out there isn't always addressed to you specifically or, you know, to your agency. But you have to understand it. You have to respect that feeling's out there.
The controversial stop and frisk policy has recently been brought up in the presidential campaign. It was declared unconstitutional in New York, where the practice, deemed to single out minorities disproportionately, began. Bradshaw says his department's policy is more like stop and talk.
You know, what we're trying to encourage our officers is have conversations with people when it's not necessarily criminally related. And I think if you do that, then everything else just kind of falls in line.
And Mesa's chief, John Meza, says he hopes the end result of the controversies will lead to a better understanding of the difficult job of modern policing.
Obviously, the use of force issues are the ones that make the headlines, and we need to deal with them. But, boy, I really wish that the community could see all the good things officers do and the sacrifices that they make every day, because the officers that come out, and I always call it a calling, they're doing this because they feel it's a calling and they want to serve.
The question remains whether his force and others in Arizona can recruit more diverse candidates to reflect the communities they police. A national survey conducted last year by Governing Magazine found huge gaps in minority officers compared to minority representation in the valley, with differences of over 30% in cities, including Phoenix and Glendale. For the show, I'm Phil Latzman in Phoenix.
The Black Obituary Project is a growing collection of obituaries about people who are still alive. Since its launch last week, it's received more than 100 submissions, which are posted on its website along with photos of the writers. And each author frames the obituary as though they'd been shot and killed by a police officer.
Malcolm Alexander Brinkley, 23, was unarmed when shot and killed in conflict with local police officers. Brinkley, a passionate and solution-seeking creative, sought spreading love and awareness as the answer to life's problems.
He believed Burns was an eccentric, scattershot display of coordinated miscalculations and quicksilver grace. Blackness was elusive to his bifurcated, biracial soul, but he still chased it.
Thomas dedicated his life to leading the black arts through black consciousness for black liberation with black, brown, and indigenous solidarity. As a poet, educator, mentor, and community member, he enjoyed life eating fried chicken, watermelon, and listening to everything hip-hop on porches on the South Side. Rashad Thomas was once a man upon this earth, yet he is no longer.
Those were Phoenix residents Malcolm Brinkley, Demetrius Burns, and Rashad Thomas reading part of their obituaries for the project. Jahan Jones is the founder of the Black Obituary Project, and he joins me now to talk about its origins and his goals. Jahan, you started this by writing your own obituary. Now, was that because you wanted to draw attention to a troubling situation, or were you thinking that as a black man, you could end up being killed at any time by someone in law enforcement?
Well, that's definitely a reality, and I think the project served two different purposes. For one, it's to show how easily black people can conceive of their own death in this country by hands of the police. These instances happen to African Americans disproportionately, and so when people so often talk about the quote talk black parents have with their children, where they're instructing them on the ways to avoid fatal conflict with the police, I wanted to show that that does have a tremendous psychological impact. Also, what I find is that so often when African Americans are killed by police, their pictures are posted about, but their stories are not. And so often there are discussions about the physical presence of these black people, how large the man was, how boisterous the black woman was being, things like that that I feel are kind of dehumanizing. And so this allotted black people an opportunity to tell their own stories from their own perspectives. Of course, should these obituaries need to be used, that would bring about an entirely different sort of tragedy.
Is it something that people you knew actually sort of had to consciously think about, even if they didn't put it in an obituary project, but they were thinking about, hey, I could be shot by police tomorrow?
Absolutely, absolutely. So I would say, just as I was speaking of the, quote, talk African-American parents have with their children, where they're instructing them, if you meet an officer, make sure you're polite, make sure you have your hands up at all times, make sure you're walking upright, make sure your pants are pulled up. You know, that instills a certain psychological trauma in black youth, because what you're doing is essentially telling them that they are inherently threatening and that they need to do a number of things to prevent themselves from succumbing to fatal force from the police. And so often we think about the talk as this sort of benign necessity that black parents will speak to their children, and as a result of that, black children will be safer. But what this project does is kind of turn that idea on its head. The fact that you have these swaths of people speaking to their children about how to tend to the occasionally fragile sentiments of other human beings who walk this earth, who just happen to be empowered with a gun, that is a problem.
What did it feel like to write your own obituary? Did you look at it as an artist, as a writer, as a journalist, or did you look at it as someone really facing his own mortality?
I looked at it as an artistic project and also a journalistic project. I am of the belief that journalism, in its truest sense, requires more than just speaking realities, but also contextualizing them. And so from an artistic perspective, I thought of the best way I knew how to make sure this project reaches a number of people and touches them at a foundational level. As a journalist, I was able to use my writing skills and my editorial skills to encircle a number of other people in this project. Now, in writing my own obituary, I didn't find it especially difficult because, again, these are things I believe black people are thinking about constantly. The idea that we walk this earth with the understanding that our lives could be taken at any moment for any reason leads us to a certain level of introspection that I think may not be occurring among other people groups.
Black people, African American people have to worry about this on a regular basis a heck of a lot more than other groups do. But
right,
there are still people who are not black who are involved in this sort of thing. So why did you decide that this should focus on African Americans?
Because I think the rate at which it occurs among African Americans is especially troubling. And that's not to say that when the police shoot and kill people of other ethnicities, that that's not troubling. That also is, but this project is intended to speak to a very particular circumstance. So we're not neglecting other sorts of police violence, but we are absolutely highlighting the fact that it happens at such a disproportionate rate among African Americans, and that there's a reason why that happens that our country needs to wrestle with.
That's Jahan Jones, founder of the Black Obituary Project. And that's all for today's edition of the show on 91.5 and KJZZ.org. Be sure to join us tomorrow afternoon at 2 when we'll get out our 10 speeds and learn about bikes in Ajo. And we'll learn about how blind writers are helping each other get published. That's tomorrow afternoon at 2 on the Tuesday edition of the show. And if you want to catch any of our past shows or segments, you can go to KJZZ.org or download the free KJZZ app to your smartphone. That's the show for today. This has been a KJZZ original production from Phoenix. You can find photos, audio segments, and more information about the program at theshow.kjzz.org. I'm Steve Goldstein. Thanks for listening to the show podcast.